Welcome to Ear to the Pavement. I'm Allison Learish-Dean. Here today on the show are historian Barbara J. Fields and political scientist Adolph Reed, and we're talking about the South. The Southern United States has long been perceived as regionally distinct in ways that don't apply to other parts of the country. At the same time, the South has undergone enormous changes over the past couple of centuries and continues to evolve rapidly in ways that confound our often fixed images of it. The region's distinctiveness in the popular imagination is in large part due to slavery and the Jim Crow regime. Both were defeated, but their legacies continue to reverberate in the way Americans understand their past and conduct their politics. But even as the South persists as a distinctive idea, Southerners have had to contend with the same forces of place-destroying precarity ravaging other parts of the country, like the increasing burden of housing, transportation, and healthcare costs, and the failure to ensure the delivery of public goods like clean water and education. These conditions make it harder and harder for working-class people in particular to forge and maintain stable connections to places. But connection to place is arguably a precondition for democratic politics. As William Leach put it in his 1999 book, Country of Exiles, quote, "Without a sense of boundaried place, there can be no citizenship, no basis for common bonds to others, no willingness to give to the commonweal or be taxed, even lightly, in behalf of the welfare of others." Barbara Fields is a professor at Columbia University specializing in the history of the American South. She has written extensively about American slavery and the Civil War. Her book, Racecraft, The Soul of Inequality in American Life, was co-authored with her sister, the sociologist Karen Fields, and critically examines how a commitment to the notion of race inflects class politics in the United States. Adolph Reed is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. His most recent book is No Politics But Class Politics with Walter Ben Michaels. Reed has written extensively, both academically and journalistically, about U.S. class politics and how they are influenced by concepts of race. Presently, he is a columnist for The Nation magazine and a regular contributor to the very excellent Class Matters podcast. As I understand it, in one way or another, you've both thought a lot about the South as a place and as, you know, part of our national political imagination. And I'm wondering, I recently read an article by Barbara that was from 2015, her address to the Southern Historical Association, and it was about displacement. And Barbara spells the word displacement in the article D-Y-S-P-L-A-C-E-M-E-N-T as in dystopia, for example. And what I thought was really interesting about the DYS version of displacement is this idea that you can be dislocated or displaced, so to speak, without actually geographically really moving anywhere. Mm-hmm. I'd like to start, maybe Barbara, you could say a few things about this word displacement and what you were thinking when you came up with it.
Well, as anybody knows, Adolph probably knows, when you have to come up with it with a speech on deadline, not all of the processes involved can be said to be systematic. Some things just come to you and you pick them up and try to elaborate them because you know you have to do something. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to pretend that I spent years ruminating on this concept. And one of the circumstances that brought it to my mind, as I say at the beginning of the essay, is a book I had recently read by an airline pilot who was talking about what it feels like to go at high speed from one place to another place. And he's the one who coined the term place lag, which he said was an analog to jet lag, having to do with the way rapid jet travel from one place to another upsets what he called our deep old sense of place. And thinking about that, I realized that there's an upset to that deep sense of place that happens to people as individuals, as it might to an airline pilot. But then there's one that happens to people as a class or as a neighborhood or as a class, a group of some kind, that's not just about going from one place to another, but having the sense of place really destroyed because the place has been taken over in one way or another, perhaps by a hurricane, but then by the people who are planning what to do after the hurricane, or it might be by developers. As I said in the article, it might be by the people who take over in the event of a bankruptcy or near bankruptcy, and who become the rulers of that place beyond any kind of democratic politics or determination. They're empowered to say, this is the way it can be, the way it will be, including deciding we're going to take the municipal drinking water from an unsafe place and make people drink it, as happened in Flint. So then I was thinking about that kind of displacement, and I thought it has something to do with Southern history, so maybe this is an appropriate thing to say, to talk about in my presidential address, because as I began by saying that people understand something when you speak of the South that they don't necessarily understand as distinctly or think they do when they speak of other parts of the country. And yet, that's not because the South is not changing and because it is not becoming unrecognizable in some ways to people who live in a particular part of it, and or unaffordable for people who live in a particular part of it. So I decided that is one of the themes of Southern history.
I'm wondering whether you both feel, since you're both from Southern places, Adolf, in your case, New Orleans, and I know, Barbara, you have kind of a complex relationship to Charleston, even though you didn't entirely grow up there. Do you?
But I grew up in Washington, D.C., which is the South as far as I'm concerned, or it used to be.
Right, right. Do you, you describe in the article that the loss, that displacement is the loss of a sense of identification with other persons through a shared connection to geographical place. And I'm wondering if you both individually can identify with that experience. I'm trying to get at this idea of what the South is and this idea that it's stronger in some ways for people like yourselves who have this connection to the South, but have lived extensively in other places and in fact don't live in the South at all at this point.
Well, let me start by saying that a sociologist many years ago did try to conceptualize this. John Shelton Reed talked about Southerners as an ethnic group, as he and his colleagues put it. And one of his conclusions was that a sense of being a Southerner is much stronger in people who've been somewhere else. The people who have never been anywhere else, who've never been to school outside the South, haven't traveled much. If they were asked in a survey about being a Southerner, they were just puzzled by it in the way a goldfish might be puzzled by being asked what it's like to live in water. Mm-hmm. And it was people who had been out somewhere, either physically out or out because of their education and so on, who were likely to understand right away what the question meant. Are you a Southerner? That sort of thing. And I think you're right in saying that for me certainly, and I'm sure for Adolf as well, part of our understanding of the South, our interest in it, has to do with having been outside it. C. Van Woodward himself once, well, more than once, spoke of living in New Haven, Connecticut. He taught for many years at Yale as being in the deep North.
Adolf, do you have any reflections on that idea? I mean, how do you?
Well, yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, like in the same way, I like the goldfish and water analogy, because it's in the same way that Irish Americans are 500 times more conscious of being Irish than Irish people in Ireland are. And also in the same way that Italian immigrants didn't become Italian until they got here, right? Or mm-hmm. Polish immigrants the same. I mean, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I think that there are probably other qualifications too. I mean, the extent to which living in other places is also connected with a class background in ways that also can shape a sense of one's ethnic identity, right? Mm. It seems to me, ethnicity seems increasingly to me to be a category or a leitmotif, like within a class system, basically. But I want to say this about the Southern thing in particular, because I've been spending a lot more time both in the region in general, like in the last 25 years because of work, but also in New Orleans in particular. And one thing I find especially disconcerting is how the past lives imagistically within the present. And I mean, in much of the South now, that's because of the heritage tourism industry. But I mean, for me, existentially, right? In the sense that what I describe in the book as something like scar tissue is like part of everyday experience. I mean, still every time I drive past the Orleans Parish Courthouse, I'm repelled by the motto that's emblazoned on the structure, the impartial administration of justice at the foundation of liberty. I mean, even though that's in some ways more likely to be true about the local criminal justice system than it was 50 years ago, still, like, the image of what it meant 50 years ago pops into my head. So it's a kind of a weird experience of both past and present. I don't think that's so much about the region as it is about age, right, and sort of straddling two historical and political economic eras, right, something like the Steppenwolf in that sense. But I think especially in thinking about the South, as you know, the category has always been at least as much an ideological one as a geographical or a cultural one. I remember reading J. William Harris's book, Deep South, a number of years ago, and being struck that the notion of the Deep South itself only dates from the 1920s, right, or perhaps even later. And paying attention to regional, differentiation according to political economy and climate topography is quite important. So it just.
Well, I think what I'm trying to get at is in the article, Barbara talks about the loss and sense of identification, the loss of a sense of identification with other persons through a shared connection to geographical place. And then later on, she goes on to talk about this idea that sense of collective identification with a place is actually connected to the possibility of democracy, and it's also connected to the erosion of democratic possibility. And there's this idea of the South as a physical location that has certain landscapes and physical attributes. It could be having to do with nature or architecture, and that as those things change and disappear, the idea of what the South is evolves in some way. But then there's also this idea of markets, as she puts it in the article, fostering the displacement that undermines democracy, and that's also happening in the South too. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is, what are the implications for democracy? I mean, there's so many things that are interfering with our ability to collectively identify with each other in connection with specific places, right? I mean, and you know, some of them are literally people who can't afford to live in places being displaced. It may be the erosion of the camaraderie that comes with being part of a union. Mm-hmm. It may be that you're an academic who's constantly moving from one job to another because you're chasing either a better sort of lifestyle or a better salary. And then there's, of course, the idea that we're all kind of filtering so much through the internet, which is changing our sense of, I think, local identity in a lot of ways. And I think I'm trying to get at the implications of that for democracy, but through like a Southern lens, because the South has this particularly strong idea of place. I mean, not just in the heads of Southerners of various kinds, but also, you know, some of the strongest concepts of the South that I've encountered are from people who have never lived there, don't have anything to do with it. So I think I just wanted to get at that question of democracy. How does it relate to this sense of collective place? Is the South in some way better at that, you know, that connection to shared local identity? And is that a good thing? Or has that fallen apart? I mean, I feel like it's more fallen apart than not, but if you could
think it's falling apart everywhere. Mm-hmm. Partly, I think that's because the information media, the news media, and so on, and the internet and the news media as presented by the internet, because I think many people, probably like me, don't even watch television news, but we get it on the internet anyway. Mm-hmm. But part of what that means is that the notion of red states and blue states actually seems to stand for something real in people's minds, to the extent that you can have people who are otherwise sane, and I'm speaking of people who are in some sense on our side, saying, well, you know, we should just split. Let the red states go their way and we'll stay our way. Mm-hmm. You know, and there was a discussion in the Washington Post. I don't remember what the original article was, but it was about Texas. And somebody said, well, just tell me one good thing that's ever come out of Texas. You know, this kind of, and of course, anybody could. Mm-hmm. And if people were sitting calmly and in their right minds, they would realize that there's not a state in the union that doesn't have people who are on the left as well as people who are on the right and all kinds of places in between. And if they were thinking sanely about it, they would understand that if they had any historical notion of what partition has meant, mm-hmm. you know, in the Indian subcontinent, for example, or in Ireland, mm-hmm. They wouldn't be speaking so blithely about it. They would understand that if you really mean that, then you're talking about cleansing, ethnic or otherwise, and about forced migration of people. Mm-hmm. But it's a sense of what places are that bears no or little relationship to what people actually know and understand if they were thinking without that template. Spending too much time listening to talking heads, perhaps.
Are you saying that this, I mean, as an example, this red state, blue state idea has kind of supplanted a more nuanced understanding of one's relationship to a locality?
I'm just saying that it's superimposed over it in ways that can make it hard for people to think straight. Mm-hmm. So it can lead people to talk about a state or an area in a blanket way when they know perfectly well that it's not true. So you say, just let Mexico take Texas. Mm-hmm. When abolitionists said, and there was a strain of the abolitionist movement that said this, we should just let the slave states go. Mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass, among others, reminded them that means that you are abandoning the slaves to a situation in which we have no more control over what happens to them than we have over what happens to slaves in Brazil or Cuba. And it's that kind of thinking that I was talking about, that you forget that you have allies or potential allies, and you write them off by that sort of thinking. And it's not just about place. Red state, blue state reminded me of it, because it's a lazy habit that I understand why journalists do it, because they're lazy, by the way. But those who consume journalism need to resist it. And need to and it's related, I think, to the inability in some quarters of the people who are in politics by profession. It's related to their inability to think in class terms about their what they say are their objectives. They're writing off of people, let's say, in rural areas because, oh yeah, those are red state people. Instead of thinking, what are the just grievances, the predicaments of these people that we ought to have something to say about if we're really, if we're serious about our political commitments. While you're thinking about them as wearing red hats, you're not thinking about them as having had all the hospitals in their area shut down by the health industrial complex, by not having access to drug treatment and so on, so that they get noticed by people who say, oh yeah, white people are suffering because of deaths of despair, and you don't have people on the other side talking about what the reason is. And what we have to offer as a riposte to that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on that point. For a second too, and like take it back to one of our common reference points, which is South Carolina. So I've worked in South Carolina in political projects off and on since the early 70s, but especially in the last 20 or so years, and around 2005 and 6, I was involved in a project of a ballot access campaign to win a ballot line for a Labor Party in South Carolina, which we did. But that required engaging more closely with partisan politics in the state than I had theretofore. And one of the things that struck me, and my friend and colleague and former grad school mate, Professor Willie Leggett, who's recently retired from South Carolina State as a political scientist. And I figured out, we did an article about this actually in Nonsite, that Willie was looking one day at V.O. Key's classic Southern Politics in State and Nation, 1949 study. And in reading the section on South Carolina, he read to me a passage where Key's description of the role that race played in South Carolina politics in 1949, and it struck us both that you could say basically, with just changing a few words here and there, the same thing about the role that race played in South Carolina politics in 2006, with the difference being that it meant the same thing for blacks and black and white politicians and Democrats and Republicans, that both camps were committed to the idea that race should be the central fault line in electoral politics in the state of South Carolina, just as they were in 1949, but that the universe had been expanded so that blacks got to do it too, basically. So it wasn't just about keeping blacks down, but it was instead about the same thing in 2006 that it had been ultimately in 1949, which was keeping class and political economy off the political agenda. And a lot of the work that we did was at flea markets, which in South Carolina, as a lot of other places, are like, you know, poor people's shopping malls. And what we heard from as much as anything else, from everybody that we interacted with, without regard to race or age, was that it was exciting to see that there was some political group trying to operate in the state that actually wanted to focus on the issues that people who work for a living are concerned about on a daily basis: jobs, healthcare, education, mm-hmm. Housing. And in that sense, so one sort of continuity within change, basically, is that Southern politics has accommodated to the to incorporation of Black or reinstatement, I guess is the best way to put it, of Black people's citizenship rights, mm-hmm. In a way that maintains the class character of the political system as it was under segregation, but in a new context, in a context in which both Democrats and Republicans and Black political actors and white, you know, come together to sustain a commitment to a fundamental commitment to neoliberal market driven principles of intensifying inequality.
Right. So the argument becomes like, well, we can't have these things because it would be racist
right.
to have them.
Right.
Like, that's yeah, that's sort of the underlying. So
yeah, and it seems to me that this is the reason I was so excited when I saw the manuscript that eventually became Adolf's book, The South, which talked about the way people emphasize slavery as the essential defining experience that accounts for Black people's politics as well as the country's forever and ever. And that reading, of course, is the one that underwrites the sort of class definitions of what's at stake that Adolf is talking about, because mm-hmm. it's based on the assumption that slavery defined everything. So nothing that happened after that, as for example, capitalism, mm-hmm. has anything to do with people's the situation people are in now. And to say it's all about race becomes a metaphor and a euphemism and an excuse not to talk about what the actual situation is. But if you define all subsequent politics in terms of slavery, then you you can evade talking about, well, what replaced slavery?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or you can pretend that nothing replaced slavery because it's still here.
Right.
You know, and we have people who say almost that.
Right. In terms of dealing with that problem that you're talking about, I'm wondering how what you talk about in this displacement article, this kind of loss of this shared identity around a local place, which can be oppressive. I mean, I'm not trying to you make it really clear in the article that you're not romanticizing that. But is there a consequence from that that you can identify for organizing against this sort of stuff that you're talking about?
Yeah. If you approach it as an organizing issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then,
mm-hmm.
Then insofar, well, yeah, I found a couple of things, and maybe I'm going to go a little bit around the Robin Hood's barn, as my grandmother used to say, to get to an answer.
Right.
But, so when I left Chapel Hill and went out to Eastern North Carolina to work as an organizer, part of the wisdom was, so, and look, I'll be honest, like I had to train myself to say ain't or and a ma'am, right, before I left. Right. I mean, it was, and that also been hipped by union organizers that, like, when I moved to North Carolina and I saw this town 10 miles outside Kannapolis and read the name, and I just assumed it was pronounced Concord. And, like, organizers explained to me, no, you better call it Concord, because if you don't, like, you'll get arrested for being a union organizer, basically. Mm-hmm. But in addition to stuff like that, there, you know, part of the wisdom of embedding oneself in the community was that you had to go to church and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And yeah, I just wouldn't do it. Right. I mean, and was convinced, and I believe that, history vindicated me. Like, I was convinced that if you talk to people honestly about the concerns that are impelling them in their lives and struggle with them on behalf of those issues, then they don't care where you're from, right? I mean, they don't care how long you've been there, right?
Right, yeah.
And I found that to be the case, like, in South Carolina, too. I mean, if you're you don't have to be from the place to be embedded in the work, and what people value most of all is you know, demonstrated willingness to struggle with them on behalf of the issues that they're concerned about. So
let me just add that it seems to me, in the same spirit as Adolf's experience going to the flea market and talking to people and finding out what interested them, that was what struck me listening to Christopher Smalls and his colleagues who organized the union at the Amazon warehouse. Mm. With people whose views about all kinds of issues were all over the place.
Right.
And they eventually decided we need to focus on what it is that people who are in this warehouse doing this work under this management, what they find wrong, what they want fixed, what they need. And don't get sidetracked on the issues that you can't possibly settle.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We don't have to discuss who voted for Trump and who didn't vote for Trump, that's not what's relevant here.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, by the way, I mean, that's like one thing that we're, and pardon the plug, but we have a podcast called the Class Matters Podcast.
It's a great podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I second that.
One of the things that we're especially scrupulous about on that podcast is, our tagline is, we want to be the place where people come to talk about what the country would look like if it were governed by and for the working class. Mm-hmm. And one of our targets is, like, intermediate level trade union leaders who are trying to figure out how to combat or better preempt Trumpism, like, among their members. But and we're scrupulous about not engaging, like, in any of that, right? Not appearing to be partisan, anti-Republican, or because issues that most affect working people are basically the same, and responses coming from the Democrats or from the identitarian left, and from the right are all basically smoke screens to get around confronting what those actual concerns are. And
right.
And I've been saying for, like, more than 30 years now that I just do not understand how we can expect to get to a point of establishing the solidarities that we have to challenge, even to try to challenge effectively, the class forces that are operating against all of us as working people, if we have to start out from going around the room and pointing out and acknowledging how we all differ from one another.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't work. And it just seems more and more like the devil's work. And therefore, it's no accident that Bezos and other, gazillionaires dumped dumped at least $2 billion like into anti-racist campaign within less than a month after George Floyd's murder.
Right.
Yeah, and I was noticing the other day in the midst of the news media's focusing on the police beating in Memphis. And during the time of that intensive broadcasting, another story, I won't say it surfaced because it was very hard for it to break surface, but two police officers were charged in, I've forgotten the name of the place in Arkansas, Mulberry, I think, perhaps, who had beaten a white man. He didn't die, as it happened, but brutally beat a white man after he had been restrained. And not only did that story barely break surface, but it wasn't connected with the Memphis story or any of the other stories about police being off the chain like this, but it was part of the same story. And we'll never be able to confront it when it happens to Black people if we allow the story of how it happens to working people across the board to be buried under the anti-racism nonsense.
And that's such an important point, Barbara, and we see it all the time too. And increasingly it seems like race as an ideology and as a discourse of hierarchy has always, and by always I mean, and take this Afro-pessimist, for the 150 years to 200 years or so that it's been around as a category, it's always done the same work. And that work is to make capitalism's class contradictions disappear and
Yes.
to make them into some version of culture. And I'd add to that observation that there once was a time, not that long ago, when what counted as racism began with the belief that races exist as natural populations in the world. And somehow there's a nominal left understanding now that that belief should only count as racist if it comes with the subsequent belief that non-whites are inferior to whites.
Right.
But the fact is that racism, and both Walter Ben Michaels and I, quite independently of each other, have been saying for years, the way to understand what race is, it is that whenever you think it or hear it, think unicorn. But you can taxonomize unicorns until the cow comes home or the cows come home, because it's a fiction. So you can make up the category. It's like as much as you want. And as people who have studied racialist ideology and race science as an ideology in particular have said repeatedly that if you go out looking for evidence of race, you'll find it, whether or not it exists. Right, because that's what scientific protocols do. And I'll say one last thing about this, because this was like a bug that was up me before a couple hours before we started. But for at least the second half of my teaching career, I taught almost every year, or at least every other year, a grad seminar on race theory in the U.S. and the world from the Victorian era to now. And I had the same experience often with grad students that would come in and get demoralized after a couple of weeks, because everybody comes in thinking that we're going to read, or comes into a course like this thinking that, or set to think that there was a benighted time back in the day when people believed all this horrible stuff. And then we defeated a lot of it and got better. And what the students get kind of transfixed by for a while is seeing that it's actually the same tropes of inegalitarian ideology and racial determinism, right? Mm-hmm. Recur over and over and over. The specific metaphor, the historically specific metaphors change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you don't ever defeat the fundamental commitment because it's not intellectual. It's an ontological commitment. It's a deep belief in naturalized inequality,
mm-hmm.
which is like the native ideology of all upper classes anyway. So it makes sense that right there run through the universities. But then the happy ending is that they come out the other end of it and they realize, well, yeah, the problem is that we don't defeat racism by debunking Sir Cyril Burt and the made up and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
We defeat racism by winning an egalitarian society.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think of a tactic that one of my former students uses in his classes, or he did in the past. Michael West.
Oh yeah.
Told me that, and he teaches at a university where at least some of his classes are mainly, if not all, white students, although others are not. And he told me that he began the semester passing out cards and telling the students, please write your name here and tell me about yourself, anything that you think is pertinent about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And they write down whatever they write down, and then he collects the cards and he hangs on to them for a while. And then the first time they have a discussion during which a student speaks up and says, well, as a white person, he interrupts and says, no, there are no white people in this class.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the students gape at him.
Uh-huh.
And then he pulls out his little cards. He says, not one of you wrote down here, I'm a white person. You mm-hmm. wrote, and he points at somebody, you wrote that you play football.
Uh-huh.
And you told me that you play the trombone, and you said this mm-hmm. or that. Not right. one of you said, I'm a white person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure, I don't know how long it stuck, but I'm pretty sure the students understood from that little exercise that he was telling them something about accepting a definition, an abstract definition of who they are, and allowing that to substitute for who they know they are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's great to hear. Michael's doing that too.
I hope he's still doing it. He told me this some years ago, but I thought it was just such a great thing to do,
yeah.
although I knew I couldn't pull it off, but he certainly can because he has a persona like that with his students.
Yeah.
And all kind, they're not surprised after a while that he says something that sounds as though it's off the wall.
Yep.
And he can do it with the best deadpan.
Yep. Yeah, he's a great guy. And is author of the most insightful critique of the race relations idea ever.
What's the title of it?
It's called The Education of Booker T. Washington.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Let me just, I actually have to go in a few minutes, but I wanted to try to bring it back around to this question of place.
Mm-hmm.
And the South in particular. How does the way that our relationships to places are changing now or have changed, how does it impact that? And I mean, maybe a better way to ask it is just like, Barbara, what is the relationship between the democracy that we need and this disruption in place that you talk about in the article?
I have to say at the outset, I can't claim originality for this because what started me thinking about it was a book published by a then colleague, William Leach, called Country of Exiles, whose major argument was that democracy as a political practice cannot be if people don't feel a sense of responsibility for each other to the extent that they are prepared to sacrifice something if need be for the common weal.
Yep.
And that's basic for democracy. And he argues further that that kind of commitment to other people starts with commitment to people who are in a place that you recognize as a place. It can't be a commitment to the globe. It can't be world citizenship.
Or a commitment to the blue state people.
Yeah, it has to start with a commitment that's based where your feet are.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And from there, you can build to a commitment to people whose feet are in a similar place, even if it's not yours, and to an understanding of what the common grievances and the common oppressor is. Mm-hmm. And I think, and so I was deeply influenced by Dr. Leach's argument about that. And I had it in my mind, as you'll see from the footnotes in the displacement article. Mm-hmm. I think it's fundamental to some kind of democratic politics. Mm-hmm. The abstractions, race is one of them, and we have all kinds of shiny objects that can draw people off the scent as soon as issues of class oppression are under discussion.
Yep.
The only way around that is political activity that calls people's attention back to what actually means something to them, where they are, where their feet are planted.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I absolutely agree with that. And I think I would add that part of the role of the political militant, and I know that like this doesn't comport well with the kind of civics books understanding of how people move, but is to agitate for ways of understanding that shared place can be the workplace or the neighborhood or the family or the bowling league or the kinship group, right? I mean, and to deepen it and broaden it, right? The sociologist Rogers Brubaker asks he makes the point that people, all of us, have all kinds of identities and what are in effect ethnic identities that coexist. And he asks, what are the conditions under which some of those identities become politicized? And his answer is that his response is that the most likely circumstance is when political entrepreneurs want to pursue agendas that require the support of a population that's considerably larger than the number of people who would benefit directly from the realization of that agenda. Right? That's when people will most likely agitate for a particular identity, and especially an ethnic one, or they're all ethnic, like in some ways, right? Right. Stamp be an ethnic identity. Mm-hmm. That's pertinent to pursuit of that objective. So that's saying, among other things, that politics, well, it's always politics, and politics is always about that kind of agitation, trying to create a majority or create an effective, right? I mean, political community or force, right? Mm-hmm, that can buy, to realize whatever the agendas, the material agendas are that drive it all, and that means, among other things, that all the talk about primordial ethnic hatred is just bogus, right? Mm-hmm, right, complete baloney.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, thank you both so much. Ear to the Pavement is produced by me, Allison Learish Dean, in association with Progressive City. Progressive City Radical Alternatives is an online publication dedicated to ideas and practices that advance racial, economic, and social justice. We feature stories on inclusive urban planning practices and civic action. Visit Progressive City at progressivecity.net, where you'll find past episodes of Ear to the Pavement, as well as articles. You can follow me on Twitter at Ear to the Pavement. That's E-A-R followed by the number 2 and then the pavement. Follow Progressive City on Facebook and Twitter at PCityRadical.